remember the moment you learnt to read, when it suddenly clicked that those random squiggles meant something? Award-winning children's author Sally Rippon does, and now she's sold more than 10 million copies of her books around the world. But she also remembers the moment she realised that reading was not clicking for her son. And she's written about where that moment led her and them in a new book, Wild Things, How We Learn to Read and What Can Happen If We Don't. Sally Rippon, what a pleasure to welcome you to Life Matters today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this is a book about your son's struggle to read, but also about your own love affair with reading, which started quite young. Tell us about that moment for you when reading clicked.
That's right. Well, for me, it did feel like it clicked. It's like you said, it was all the squiggly lines on the signs and everything that I could see around me. It felt like it was something that happened in an instant. But I also had to remind myself that I grew up with a primary school teacher as a mother. So she'd introduced me to reading and read to me lots. And you know, she'd been practicing with me quite a lot since I was born. And for a lot of children, that is the way that it will happen. There will be enough work done at home with your child, reading to them lots, introducing them to language, so that when they start school, it's a fairly easy thing for them to learn with a teacher. But that didn't happen with my son. It was a very different experience for him.
Well, and for you also, there was this weird childhood where you were hanging out in hotels for some chunks of time. Tell us a bit about that and how books played a role there.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Because of my father's work, he's a civil engineer, but his company was a British one. We moved around every couple of years because of his job. So mainly around Southeast Asia, Hong Kong, Singapore, and I also studied in China for a while when I was a young adult. So yeah, hotel rooms were somewhere very familiar for us. And when we'd run out of books to read, because I was a very big reader and my mother was also a very big reader, she would give us pencils and paper and we'd make our own books. And I can really credit that to what inspired me to become a writer. I think that was a way that I felt like I could get my feelings out and I could feel connected to the world. Obviously, this is a long time before the internet. So that was a way I could express myself. And it came very easily to me. So it was something that really meant that then school became easy for me too, because if you can read and write, school is easy, it's accessible. And also you get your teachers on side. You know, teachers love a child that can really do well in the classroom, and I was one of those kids.
Yeah, and then there's that praise spiral, isn't there?
Absolutely. So yeah, the more praise I get, the harder I work. And so I feel like school was an easy place for me. I mean, obviously in my adolescence, there were other things that were going on that made school a little bit more challenging. But I always felt like the teachers were on my side and they understood me. And I always felt like learning was easy and accessible and something that was open to me. And so that was something I'd always taken for granted.
And that was how it worked out with your first two sons as well, who were not only great readers but bilingual. You must have felt that this was this fantastic, natural, familial process. Tell us a bit about how your ideas about how humans read changed over time.
Absolutely. So I spent the first half of my career traveling the world and visiting schools all across the world, speaking at conferences to parents and teachers. And I had been sold the myth, and it had played out for me and also my two older sons, that if you just read enough to your kids or you give them a wide enough access to all the literature they want to read, then they'll just pick it up eventually. And I was lucky enough that this happened for me. I was also lucky enough it happened for my sons, not only in English, but also in French, because their father is French. And so I was among the many people that just assumed that that was going to be the case for everyone. And it wasn't until my third son came along, this beautiful, sunny, bright little kid, that those things weren't happening. And I just spent a lot of time in denial, just thinking, no, look, I'm a children's author. I'm doing all the right things. He's grown up in a household of books. Surely it will click. And I think that it was just putting it off and having that denial that really, now I know looking back, was the problem, that we really needed to look at those red flags earlier.
Well, it seems to me from reading the book that there were a lot of problems. There were structural problems. There were problems about ignorance and denial, lots of stuff going on. And Sally Rippon, you write really honestly about your desire to shield your son from the knowledge that he was falling behind in primary school. Tell us about that day in the car with the NAPLAN results and how that affected you and him.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it is really tricky, because I do still believe that there are many ways a human can be a wonderful contributor to the world outside of just being able to read and write. But I really had underestimated how much reading affects everything. Because I think when my son got to grade three and he started saying things that no parent likes to hear, like, you know, I hate reading, I hate books. And then, of course, I hate school. I just had assumed he wouldn't be a reader. And so I thought if I can just find enough things that he is good at and feel good enough about himself, that will be enough. And I really hadn't taken into account how much reading affects everything. So it's not just being able to access beautiful stories and, you know, find out the way that other people in the world live or the way that other people think, but everything. I mean, maths requires reading, just getting around in any single subject requires reading. So he was fairly sheltered for most of primary school. And you talk about that example that I give in the book of the NAPLAN results when we opened up those results in the car, and he could see quite easily himself because it's all laid out in dots where he was among his peers. And I thought, all I have to do is just make sure he doesn't know this about himself. But in fact, that was a big mistake. I really needed to get onto that quickly, because primary school is fine. You know, they have one teacher looking out for them and looking out for all their strengths. But by the time he got to high school, then he had many different teachers and he was supposed to be in many different classrooms throughout the day. That was when it really became clear that the wheels were falling off. And not only was he unable to access his studies, but his mental health was affected as well, his self-esteem. So I realize now in retrospect, and this is really why I wrote the book, that there are so many important things about supporting a child from early on if they can't read, and how important early intervention is.
And I think it's important to point out, as you do in the book, Sally, that you cleared all the bits that represent your son, who you're calling Sam for the purposes of this book. You cleared those with him before they went to the publisher. So this is him saying it's okay for you to tell this story. The book is called Wild Things, How We Learn to Read and What Can Happen If We Don't, by someone uniquely qualified, really, to tell this story. Sally Rippon's sold millions of books. She's an award-winning children's author in Australia who has been on this journey of dealing with the systems that encase our children and what happens when they can't be part of those systems because they struggle with reading. Perhaps this is something that resonates with you if you're listening at home. So, yes, as you write, Sally, high school, a nightmare for kids who struggle to read. And there's this really heartbreaking passage when Sam was in high school when you write that you felt you'd been expecting too much of our education system, that it would support kids like Sam in the way that he needed. Why is that too much to ask? Why can't our school systems do that?
I think you're absolutely right. That's a really good point that I want to make. First of all, thanks also for clarifying that Sam has given me complete carte blanche to tell this story, and all of the parts that feature him, I run past him. I think that's really important, particularly because we're really creating a space for people to self-advocate. And once you get beyond, once you're a young adult and you're beyond 18, it's really important that we listen to people talk about their own experiences. But up until 18, it was my job really to back up Sam. And I think because I'm a children's author and I had assumed that I knew all the things that it took to become a reader, and I'm a reader myself, I didn't really advocate early enough. And there are lots of incredible parents out there who start very early. They can see very early on that the signs are that potentially the milestones aren't being met. So there's simple things like pronouncing words incorrectly past about grade three, or not developing required reading skills after about grade three, because up until grade three, we're taught to read, but from grade three onwards, we're expected to read to learn. So I had to learn to be an advocate. I had to upskill, and I tapped into some incredible parent support groups, the Dyslexic Victoria support group, for example, and they gave me so much information. And I guess the great thing about now having access to that information and also potentially having written a lot before is I thought, you know, I need to put all of this somewhere. It is all out there, but it's very hard to find, and a lot of it's very dense. There's a lot of books on neuroscience about what happens in our brain as we learn to read, but they're heavy going. And if you're a panicking parent, you need something that you can get the information quickly. You need to find that support system really quickly. So I kept thinking, why is this information not accessible and easy to get? And I thought, well, obviously, I have to write this book. And this feels like a way that Sam and my story hasn't been wasted. You know, we really did go through a tough time, but this feels like something we can give back where, you know, basically I say through the book, these are where I made the mistakes. Don't do what I did. Here are the things that you can do that will help your child and yourself have an easier road.
Yes, and you do write about how powerful it is when you do start sharing that story with others and how many people queue up to come and talk to you about their similar experiences at book signings. And you mentioned, Sally Rippon, the moment in schooling where it goes from learning to read to reading to learn and how difficult that moment can be for kids who are struggling to read. How much has the really fierce debate in schools over phonics versus whole reading muddied the waters or complicated things for kids with learning difficulties?
Yeah, it's a really good question, and it's one I'm always just very careful to not to wade in too deeply to, because look, what my research has shown and all the experts that I've spoken to, and obviously I'm not an expert, I'm not a teacher, but it seems that the evidence is out there that if we teach children how to decode words, so if we help them understand that the marks on the page relate to a sound and those sounds make up words, then they will be able to create that capacity. Or what actually happens is that there are parts of your brain that are rewired as you learn to read, because we're born with the capacity to know how to speak. The language is 100,000 years old, but the written language is only 5,500 years old. And so learning to read and write is relatively new, and there are parts of our brain that need to be rewired during that process. And by slowly and systematically introducing these sounds and this code to children, then that wiring happens, so children become competent readers for themselves. And there was a time where we did believe potentially that we absorbed a word like an image and then it was stored in the brain. And it can feel like that for some people, because once you do acquire those skills, it happens instantly. It feels like you're just memorizing words. But in fact, all of us go through that process where we're breaking down the words into a code, and then eventually that's how we acquire written and spoken language. It's all very complicated. It's all out there in the neuroscience, and I've tried to break it down into a very accessible way. So this argument's been raging for a while. Obviously, I can't know if it would have made a difference for Sam, because he's 19 now and he didn't get that kind of teaching. But from what I'm reading, and all the evidence is showing that probably is the best way to ensure all children can learn to read.
Now, you did finally get some diagnoses for Sam. And as you say, you know, it was pretty heartbreaking realising that, earlier intervention would have been helpful. But what did help late as that intervention was, Sally? What kinds of support were useful for Sam?
Well, it wasn't until year 9 that the Dyslexic Victoria support group suggested that I might want to get him assessed for ADHD. And I'd also had some ideas about what ADHD was that I think a lot of people still carry. You know, I thought it was just, you know, loud little boys running around the classroom. And Sam wasn't anything like that. He was a daydreamer. He was very sweet and pleasant to have around. He was no trouble. And so I thought, no, he couldn't possibly have ADHD, but I figured I may as well rule that one out. And sure enough, he came up as having ADHD as well. So the pediatrician suggested we try him on medication. And the difference was instant. It really was like all of a sudden he could focus, he could retain information. And more importantly, he was being a little bit less impulsive. He was doing a few things that were not great decisions in the world. And so the medication just helped him focus, really hone his skills. And he went in grade, I think this was now great year 10 by the time we started the medication, from grade 4 maths to getting 100% into statistics tests. And of course, I rang all my friends and said, you'll never believe what happened. But really what that did for Sam is that allowed him to realize that he is intelligent. He just needed to find where to tap into that intelligence for himself. So he chooses not to take medication now, but now at least he knows how he learns, how he'll often do things a few times to be able to feel like he's really absorbed that information. And I think the number one thing that I got from researching this book and really spending a lot of time listening to Sam, doing less talking, more listening, is really focusing on what we now know as the social model of disability. So my good friend Eliza Hull introduced that idea to us, that there's nothing wrong with the person. The person is perfect as they are. What we need to do is we need to create an environment where this person can thrive. And so Sam hadn't been given the resources he needs. So from then on, we could ask for accommodations. We could ask for more time for exams. He was able to get somebody to read his work aloud if he wanted to. But of course, then we went into COVID remote learning, and that was a bit of a nightmare anyway. But it is, you know, those accommodations are available. And as a parent advocate, once you know that and you get the confidence to advocate for your kid, they're there. And teachers want the best for your children too. They're, you know, they're on your kid's side.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the writing around that turning point of year 10 10 is really fascinating, that whole section, because it's clear that you went, right, I'm going to need to focus everything on Sam right now. You know, I've missed some things early on. I'm not going to make those mistakes again. It is a huge effort. You get an individual learning plan. You get the diagnosis. You book in all these activities for him every day so that he's using his energy. You get mentors, you get tutors, you get specialists on board. And so you're putting in this massive effort. Sally, was it easy to be able to just kind of insert that into your life?
Look, I think it's really important to highlight the fact that I'm educated, that I'm financially secure, that I also speak English and I can navigate the education system. So those were things that were easy for me to access. And I think probably what I'm hoping for this book is it does start conversations about learning difficulties and also neurodivergency within schools, because there will be many parents out there that don't have the resources that I did. And those kids are the ones that slip through the cracks. Those are the ones that really then find themselves going right off the rails. As my son was going off the rails, I was able to dedicate that time to him. I have a flexible work, for example. And so, you know, I'm in a very privileged position that I could support and help him in the way that he needed. Whereas a lot of other children, potentially, if they come from families that don't have the same resources, we really need to understand within the whole system how this can be a community that supports and backs these kids up. And that's where I think people like the fabulous Emma Rusciano giving that beautiful press club talk about what ADHD is for her is just the starting point. The more people talk about mental health, the more people will share their stories and understand what that looks like in adults and young people. And I think neurodivergency is the same. You know, we really need to become familiar with the signs that if there's a child playing up in the classroom, if they're being a wild thing, they may not be a bad person. There might just be something going on underneath that needs a bit more support.
Yes, I love the advice from the GP that you carried around with you like a mantra. There's no such thing as good or bad behaviour, just information. But it was fascinating, I think, reflecting on the conversation we just had here on Life Matters, Sally, about ADHD and how schools are just completely structurally not set up to deal with it. When you're looking at Sam's diagnosis of ADHD and dyslexia, what are some of your thoughts to finish up with on how schools could be different? Because you met so many teachers who are passionate and you said, you know, they're working in this system that's complex, outdated and flawed. What could change about that?
That's a lovely note to end on, because what I really want to get the message out there is this is a book that's incredibly supportive of teachers, that teachers do have these incredible ideas, and I interview lots of them and lots of them have suggestions. But I think the number one thing is that they're bound, like you say, from a very antiquated system that was set up really to get people to be trained to work in factories 100 years ago. So we need to be looking at the education system as a whole. There are some incredible creative schools out there that are doing different things for kids. For example, one school has a space where kids can go and do a workshop during the day. And so potentially ADHD or autistic kids might have a time booked in, but all kids can have access to that space. So it takes away the stigma of one child being taken out of the class for extra support. So many teachers I interviewed had amazing ideas. And I think once we start these conversations, once we really start thinking about how school can be a friendlier place for kids who learn differently, that's where changes can be made.
And this book is an excellent starting point. As you said, Sally, it's years of blood, sweat and tears collating this information so that other people don't have to read 138 parenting manuals or whatever it was for you. But we really appreciate you sharing some of those insights with us on Life Matters today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And all the best to you and Sam. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sally Rippon, Australia's highest selling female author, best known for the Billy B. Brown series, the Polly and Buster series. They're on high rotation in my house. And her new book, her first for adults, is called Wild Things: How We Learn to Read and What Can Happen If We Don't.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.